This is Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Brian Ellison. What does it mean to be poor? Does it just mean you have less than a certain household income or amount of savings? Is it a cultural label, a description not so much of your bank account as of your identity? How does someone get that way? And maybe more to the point, what does it take to get someone out of it? Lots and lots of questions, but the answers are complicated and contentious. Nearly a quarter century ago, one influential book sought to reshape the conversation about poverty in America. The Undeserving Poor challenged some conventional and political notions then, and in a revised edition out last month, it's challenging some new ones. Author Michael Katz is the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins us by phone from Philadelphia this morning. Dr. Katz, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. So you write that you chose the words carefully in the subtitle of this new edition of the book, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty. How enduring, really, has the confrontation been?
The confrontation with poverty is basically as old as the history of this country. There have always been people who have been unable to support themselves for one reason or another. And so, you know, there has been a continuing debate over how to help them, how to reach out to them. It started in the colonies with the application of the Elizabethan poor laws that were imported from England. It really escalated in the late 18th and early 19th centuries with the growth of cities and the spread of urban poverty, the coming of capitalism to America. And it's been with us, and it's been contentious ever since.
So what motivated these initial efforts to help the poor? Was it some sort of compassion or care, or was it seen from the beginning as sort of a political and social problem? The country needed to not have poverty if it was going to be strong.
Well, there is no single answer to that question, because people have had a variety of motives for trying to do something about poverty. I mean, there always have been people who have been deeply compassionate from ethical or religious religious concerns. There have been others who've been concerned with crime, and particularly with public expense of poverty, with questions of social disorder, with issues of regulating the labor market. So all of these things have been mixed up in this very complicated and contentious and enduring debate.
Now, one of the ways that you frame this conversation is around the question, what kind of problem is poverty? And maybe the place to start answering that question is, who do we mean by the poor? You ask, actually, first off, whether poverty is a problem of persons or of something else. What do you mean by that? How could poverty be a problem of persons?
Well, the idea that poverty is a problem of persons underlies this very old notion of the undeserving poor. The idea that for more than 200 years this theme has run through America's enduring, you know, confrontation with poverty. The idea that some poor people are undeserving of help because they brought their poverty on themselves. So that is, you know, so it is a problem of their person. It can be a result of bad behavior in this view, of inferior culture, or even of genetic inadequacy.
And that idea has, you say, been around for a long time. How does that manifest itself? So in a contemporary context, how does society accuse someone of bringing poverty on themselves?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. The identity of the people who fall into this category of the undeserving poor has shifted over time. The category has been there. Some people have always been looked at in that way. So how do you know who they are? There are basically two ways. One is by what is said. There's a lot of writing about the topic. There's a lot of demonization of certain categories of people. But there's also, interestingly, what is done. And if you look closely at the history of policy, you can see who is helped, who isn't helped, who's excluded, who's left out on the margins, and that, you know, and that sometimes gives you a much more, a much subtler and fuller view of who falls into this category of the undeserving poor.
Now, you say that the problem of persons, or the idea that poverty is about the people who are poor, is one way of understanding the problem. But you also say there are a lot of other ways that you could understand the problem of poverty than to focus on the people who are poor.
Sure. I mean, another really old way of, you know, with a long history, is to think of poverty as a problem of place. That is, that there are places, settings, spaces, like urban slums, that are breeding grounds for producing and reproducing poverty, so that the onus there moves, you know, primarily away from the individual, but to the toxic, pathological properties of the place itself. That's another. You know, there is also the view that that poverty is a problem of a lack of resources. You know, it seems very straightforward, but there has really been a lot of argument about whether or not, you know, a lack of material kind of resources is at the heart of the problem of poverty.
Is the problem essentially that people who are poor don't have money, or is there actually a deeper or broader problem?
Yeah, that the lack of money, you know, in some views is a manifestation of a kind of a deeper problem, which, you know, would be traced back to the inadequacies of people themselves. You know, it's been a strangely almost radical view that the root problem of poverty is that, you know, folks just don't have enough resources, and that if you give it to them, you know, or help them, you know, acquire them, you will really make a huge dent in the problem of poverty. I mean, there always have been some people who have argued that, but it's been a hard sell, and it still is.
And so when we ask these questions about what is the problem of poverty really about, why does it matter? How does the answer to that question have an impact on solutions or on outcomes?
Yeah, well, you know, it matters because it matters because the way in which we think about poverty, the way in which we frame the problem, the kind of ideas with which we approach the issue, you know, really frames what we do about it. So, in fact, each view of what kind of a problem poverty is lead, and there are, you know, others too, lead in different directions for programs and for policy. So this question of, you know, what kind of an issue poverty is really has enormous consequences.
We're talking with Michael Katz. He's an historian at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new edition of his 25-year-old book now, The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty. Dr. Katz, let's focus a little bit on that title, on the undeserving poor, and this distinction that society has made that some of the poor are actually more meritorious, more deserving of public or of even of individual assistance, whereas others, for whatever reason, should share more of the blame for their situation. How important has that distinction been over the years, and how important is it today?
It's been absolutely essential. I mean, it's deeply ingrained into our past. You can really, but you know, if we might step back and, you know, there's always been this issue of, you know, who deserves help. You know, we really, you know, nobody's ever really been able to help everyone who thinks they need some assistance. So where do you draw the line? This is just the most basic enduring question in public policy. So if you look back maybe at the 17th, early 18th century, the language was between what was called the impotent and the able-bodied poor. The impotent poor were those folks who just couldn't make it on their own. The able-bodied poor were those, you know, who were able to work and so on, but just couldn't earn enough to take care of themselves. And so this line was the interesting thing is no one's been able to draw this line with any kind of precision. They always fuzzy at the middle. And then what happened in the late 18th and early 19th centuries is that this distinction between the impotent and the able-bodied poor became moralized, so that it became a distinction between the undeserving and the deserving poor, which, you know, made it fraught in new kinds of ways. And so by the early 19th century, you know, poverty and poor people were talked about in these terms. And it's just gone on and on, and we still see the echoes of it today. I mean, very interestingly, in some of his recent speeches, President Obama has singled out this notion of the undeserving poor as, you know, as a persistent theme, and one, you know, that he has criticized and mm-hmm. that we've got to get rid of.
You know, it strikes me that, and you deal mostly with this on a public policy level, and we'll delve deeper into that in the second half of our program this morning. But it strikes me that there's also a psychological impact to these labels, and maybe I've been too influenced by having seen the local theater's production of A Christmas Carol over the weekend. But this Dickensian story, but where Scrooge says, when he's asked to assist the poor, he says, "Are there no poorhouses? Are there not enough prisons?" This idea that at some point it becomes a public responsibility is rooted in sort of a moral or psychological decision about what it means to be poor, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you get down to its essence, you know, I really think that our views of poverty and poor people are ethical questions. They involve, you know, a deepest sense of morality.
Yeah, well, let's stop there for a moment, and we'll come back and talk some about the public policy implications of this moral distinction, as this categorization of the poor as deserving or undeserving, the ways that has played out in American history from the time of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty even to the present day. I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation, too. Have you been or are you now among the quote-unquote the poor? Have you felt like people or policymakers regarded you as undeserving of help? And what would have been helpful? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. And share your story or your questions for Michael Katz, the author of The Undeserving Poor. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about the persistent problem of poverty in America and the solutions over the years that have largely been unsuccessful at alleviating it. Our guest is Michael Katz. He's the author of The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty. And he joins us from Philadelphia. Dr. Katz, we were talking before the break about the distinction between deserving and undeserving poor that has been the focus of a lot of American conversation as well as public policy over the years. Is there such a thing as a culture of poverty? Everyone is afraid of contributing to a culture of poverty. Does such a thing really exist?
Yeah, well, it's an idea I don't like very much and criticize it to some degree. In the book, because it's, you know, it's usually used as a way of individualizing the problem of poverty, of blaming individuals for their own condition, you know, and I think it has led in to really, you know, unfortunate ways, and underlies a lot of the kind of harsh and demeaning approaches to poverty, which unfortunately have characterized our history too many times.
Yeah, and among those approaches is this sort of consistent effort to avoid creating a sense of dependence, right? The idea that you don't want to help someone if they would become dependent on that help.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, this question of dependence is, you know, it's one of the three great issues. There's sort of like three great questions that run throughout the history of discussions of poverty, really perennial issues that frame it for the last couple of hundred years. I mean, the first of these, which we talked about, is who to help, you know, and this has been partly about the allocation of finite resources and the exercise of moral judgment. You know, the second issue is the one you just mentioned, is the impact of relief, welfare, or charity on individual behavior. You know, it's what economists call moral hazard. Does the availability of help undermine incentives to work, marry, and maintain a stable family life? And the third issue is ethical. You know, what do we owe each other, you know, beyond our families, our immediate communities? What, you know, are the limits of our social obligations?
So are there examples of public policy solutions to poverty that, that in your judgment as a historian, have avoided creating a sense of dependence?
Yes, for sure. The greatest example in American history is Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go back, you look at the condition of elderly people in this country. You know, before the expansion of Social Security, even as late as the early 1960s, and certainly before the passage of the Social Security Act in 1935, you know, it was desperate. Older people were more than three times as likely to be living in poverty as any other age group in the population. As a result of Social Security, they are now the least likely group, age group, to be in poverty. So right there, you know, we have a fantastic example.
How about the other end of the age spectrum with children? Programs like food stamps most economists would say dramatically decrease the number of children in poverty. Is that an example of a good program?
It's an example of a tremendously important program, and one that is now, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, is deeply threatened by cuts that are on the table in Congress. There are huge numbers of people for whom food stamps is their only source of income. And there's something like 43 million people in this country who draw on the program, which is now called SNAP.
Right.
And it has been really extraordinarily important.
Sounds like there's a lot of crime or medical need going on there in downtown Philadelphia today in the background. Let's take a call and again invite our listeners to the conversation. 50 years into the war on poverty, how do you think it's working? From your own life or from the lives of those around you? Are things getting better or worse? Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. And you can ask your question of historian Michael Katz. Let's talk to Mark in Shawnee, Kansas. Mark, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks.
You were just talking about programs like Social Security and food stamps and how they have helped get people out of the poverty through those programs. And I agree, but at the same time, they have a catch to them. A lot of times, if you start earning enough or have too many assets, you don't get the benefits of a disability, Social Security disability, or you don't qualify for the food stamps that you might need to, you know, get you out of that poverty. So it's kind of a catch-22 in some instances.
Yeah, it's a good question, Mark. Michael Katz, is there a risk that you accept the assistance, it doesn't get you out of the poverty, and now you just need more assistance?
Well, I don't think that is the big risk. I think what your caller, Mark, was talking about was the adequacy of the programs in meeting individuals' needs, and the point that at certain, well, with Social Security, you know, everybody gets it based on how long they've worked and their income and so on, and if your income is over a certain amount, it's taxed back. You know, disability, has some asset criteria, as do food stamps. I mean, the question with these programs really is, where do you draw the line? You know, you can't, and you know, there's no reason, and you can't give the benefits to everybody. So at some point, you have to determine the point at which you say no, and that's a really hard line to find. Mm-hmm. And there are always going to be people who are close to that line, and who unfortunately are hurt by it. You know, so I don't really know any way around that dilemma except to really keep evaluating, you know, evaluating the program and you know, the requirements for participation.
Mark, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's talk to Bill in Brookside. Bill, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Hey, I was just thinking, part of what I understand with the problem with poverty is that in the past, before suburbs, before interstate systems, people basically lived in areas where they had to come in contact with the poor on almost a regular basis. But today, we have our whole culture, our whole network built up around the possibility of being able to avoid coming in contact with the poor, seeing them on a daily basis. And when they're out of sight, they're out of mind, and the problem is somebody else's problem.
Yeah, good question, Bill. Michael Katz, does it matter how much personal contact people have with the poor, what they think the right solutions for poverty might be?
Yes, I'm sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. You know, the invisibility of poverty is a long problem. I understand, you know, what Bill is saying, but I think he's not quite accurate in the sense of how new that problem is. Because if you go really back into the 19th century, you look at people like Henry Mayhew and Charles Booth in England, or come over to this country and think about Jacob Riis or the great photography of Dorothea Lange during the Depression of the 1930s. I mean, one of the things that people concerned with the extent of poverty have always talked about has been the invisibility of the poor and the need to kind of personalize poverty, to make it much more visible, to drive home its extent.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious. You mentioned that these problems, by and large, do go back further than our memory of them does. We can remember back, though, to when your first edition of this book came out in 1989. It had a different subtitle then, From the War on Poverty to the War on Welfare. We're now 25 years almost past that. I'm curious, what has changed in your mind since the first edition of this book was published? It's been almost a quarter century.
Yeah, right. Well, a lot of people have asked me that. And in fact, I wrote a little article about the changes in the book. So, I mean, so we're really living in a very, very different time. We've, you know, when I wrote the book originally in 1989, I was, you know, and I think a lot of people were still modestly hopeful that we might see some kind of revival of reinvigoration of social programs and make some headway against poverty as a problem. I mean, the political climate, you know, which began to shift in the 80s, you know, has a rightward drift of American politics has only shifted, has only accelerated over time. So, in fact, the whole political climate in which poverty is approached is really a very different one, and we have, you know, kind of new problems or intensifications of older problems that are now part of the poverty discussion. If you look back to the late 80s, really the group that of people who were of most concern and were the object of most discussions of the undeserving poor were unmarried mothers, and particularly women of color. you know, Ronald Reagan and his infamous welfare queen and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, so the problem of poverty was kind of redefined as the problem of welfare dependency. I think to some extent that has lessened with the passage of the 1996 welfare legislation, which has decimated the roles, although not the problem of poverty. And now, if you actually look at those people who are treated really badly by public policy, you know, you come up with some really striking groups. One of them is black men. You know, there are really almost no programs to assist people who are chronically out of the labor market, have never been in it. And we've developed a kind of welfare state for black men, you know, called incarceration, which is, you know, really very bleak, but there's a real connection between the rise of incarceration and the, you know, and the rise mm-hmm. of harsh attitudes towards welfare. Another group which is really taking it on the chin are undocumented immigrants, who clearly policy, you know, if we look at how policy is played out as a very, you know, kind of unsympathetic group. So those things have changed. In the policy landscape, you know, where there have really been positive gains have been in programs that have been directed, you might say, to the deserving poor, defined as those people who participate in the regular labor market, who are working. You know, we have we in a sense deify work in the regular labor market in this country. It's an absolute good. It's something everybody should do. But on the other hand, there are so many jobs which don't pay a living wage. So how can you ask people to go out and work hard and not have enough, take home enough money to support themselves? You know, and that contradiction has led to the expansion of the earned income tax credit, which has been very successful at taking people who are, you know, not too far below the poverty line and pushing them over it. You know, it hasn't done much for those millions of people who are still mired in really deep poverty. And also we have, you know, programs of tax credits like child tax credit and so on, which have really helped the working poor you know, the problem of the working poor now is really it's really taking off with the spread of the living wage movement.
Right. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. 816-235-2888. Let's talk to JJ in East Lynn, Missouri. Good morning, JJ.
Good morning. It's good to talk to you. A pleasure speaking with you all today.
Thanks for being here.
I wanted to talk. My family and I'm a single income supporter of my family while my wife is going to college, and I'm facing an incredible amount of debt due to the student loan program, and I just wanted to see what the caller thinks about the possibility that some of the ways our government programs are subsidizing the access to credit for people in the poverty level, on the poverty level like myself, have perhaps compounded the situation rather than helped it, because it's increased the amount of debt that people in poverty have, greater than it's increased their access to a higher income.
Yeah, great question, JJ. Michael Katz, what about the extension of credit, loans, rather than the giving of money to people? What's been the impact on poverty with that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a great question, indeed, and there are a lot of aspects to the question. If we just take the access to credit question, one of the really interesting things that's gone on in poverty policy, you know, in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, has been the application of market models, you might say, to poverty work, ways of, you know, looking at poverty as a kind of a failure of markets to work well for some people, and attempts to, you know, to kind of turn that around. So one of the major aspects of that have been programs of microfinance and you know and programs of asset accumulation and other ways of bringing banking services and credit to people who were, you know, have been previously excluded. So that's all really, you know, very, very important. How much of a dent that can make on the larger problems of poverty remains to be seen, you know. But certainly, you know, there is a potential there to really help people. You know, and whether or not they're going to touch this problem of student debt, you know, is another issue. But it, but that clearly is just unconscionable, the amount of debt that students have to take on, and the consequences of that for the subsequent lives.
Thanks for the call, JJ. Another personal story and question here from Robert. He's in Overland Park, Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm calling in regards to our food program, Department of Agriculture and Corporate America working together to promote diabetes and health and heart health, poor heart health.
Okay. I need you to go very quickly, Robert. We're almost out of time.
Okay. Through the ability to purchase candy bars and soft drinks with the food card, we are promoting poor health for our children and the families in this country, and corporate America are working hand-in-hand with the government, with the Department of Agriculture, providing tax breaks to corporations and even subsidizing the use of corn sweeteners in our products.
Okay, I've got to cut you off. I'm sorry, we're going to run out of time. Do you have any response to that, Michael? Is there concern about the kind of assistance being provided?
Well, I'm sure many people share your caller's concern. You know, the larger issue that he raises, you know, which is very, very important, very interesting, is that, you know, there's widespread criticism of giving government assistance to poor people, but we help corporations every day, and the amount of government support that goes to affluent people in this country and to corporations is huge. It dwarfs the amount going to poor people.
Mm. I'm curious, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, Michael, is there reason for hope in this ongoing battle with poverty in America? Are there hopeful signs in your view?
You know, I always like to be hopeful. I think there are signs, we don't have time to go into them all right now, that in fact the invisibility of poverty, the fact that poverty has been a kind of toxic issue in politics, that is for, you know, a number of reasons, beginning to turn around. And so, you know, with a little luck, you know, we may see some progress on this front.
Well, that's something we can all hope for. I want to thank Michael Katz. He's the author of The Undeserving Poor, America's Enduring Confrontation with Poverty, out in with its second edition last month. Michael Katz, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more about our guest and about all of our subjects. You can also subscribe to our podcast or even hear the whole conversation again by going to the Central Standard page of kcur.org. We hope you'll join us tomorrow for Casey Currents on Central Standard. We'll explore our digital technological city, Digital KC, tomorrow at 10 a.m. Stay tuned now for Up to Date. The ethics professors will be joining Steve Kraske. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.